A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
Hello everyone, this is Dante here from the Spectre Podcast, the Communist Party USA Youth Project, and today I'm here with Nicholas Danby, a local activist in the Bay Area, and San Francisco specifically, and today we'll be talking about the barista struggle in SF. So, Nick, if you can introduce yourself.
Hi, Nick, or Nicholas Danby, either way. I've been a barista my whole adult life here in San Francisco, so it's about 16 years in the specialty coffee industry. That's my background. I got involved with labor organizing probably about 2 or 3 years ago, and it's been pretty interesting. It's been an uphill battle for sure. And I've been involved with the CP, but also there's the DSA SF Labor Organizing Committee, which has done a lot of great work in the city. I was involved with the Marriott strikes here and the Anchor Union campaign, which was really amazing. Fortunately, there has not been a lot of traction around baristas organizing, but there is a lot of good work going around that, which I'd love to talk about.
Well, can you give like a little more background, like why you joined the CP and
sure,
as opposed to other groups such as like DSA and such, and maybe talk about your background, like I don't know how long you've been in SF Bay Area too.
Yeah, I actually grew up in the East Bay in Albany and El Cerrito, so I've been here my whole life. I moved to San Francisco when I was 19 and have been here ever since. I only joined the CP same about like 3 years ago, I think it's been, and was directly due to like a lot of new leftists. The 2016 election was the catalyst to getting actually involved. I've always been very left-leaning in my politics. I was actually a longtime Green Party member.
Oh, nice.
That was like, you know, when I was 18, you had to register to vote and everything. And I was like, I don't really believe in the Democrats. Of course, being from California, you know, Republican is kind of they're kind of persona non grata, at least in the Bay Area. And I saw their party line, and actually, and to this day, I'm sure I would still agree with probably a lot of it. But I did become actually really disillusioned with them because of the whole Jill Stein campaign from 2016, which went off the rails. That's a whole nother story, though. But after that, I was really attracted to coming back to, like, what is socialism? How does it work? And I was really drawn to the party, mostly because they have the history. It was really important to me that they've been in the struggle for a really long time. And as I've been a party member these past couple of years, I've just learned more and more how involved they've been, especially like the labor movement with civil rights movement. And it's like pretty amazing to be involved with that. Also, my comrades here, it's kind of a small chapter here in San Francisco, but it's really strong. And the people involved have been involved for a really long time. They know a lot of people, and it's just really kind of inspiring to be around that. And they've been really warm and welcoming. I grew up around Berkeley, where a lot of so-called left-leaning folks tend to be very, I get really turned off by it because there's a lot of ideological purity. So my thoughts of, you know, activists was kind of this idea of like a lot of gatekeeping, essentially. Yeah. And I've been very working class my whole life, and I felt very welcomed by a lot of the leftists I've come to meet, and not just even in the party, but elsewhere. And it's like, that's been really important to me. And I think that's really important when it comes to just building a movement. And like, this is for everyone. Yes. And the whole idea of the CP is like, this is a party for like the whole working class, no matter where you come from. And that's like so important.
So I guess we should slowly dive into the major thrust of the conversation. First off, talk about the history of labor organizing in food service, or particularly in, let's say, coffee shops or barista organizing. If there's any sort of historical moments that you want to point out, feel free to as well.
Yeah, for sure. Unfortunately, there has not been. There's not a lot of history here. I know there are sectors of the food service industry that are unionized, like definitely certain cafeteria workers or the SEIU. But unfortunately, it's very separate from the kind of industry that I've been involved with. And I think that's been like a historical issue with organizing people in food service, specifically also especially coffee, which is the name of kind of what I do. And just to, for people who are not aware of what that means smaller coffee shops, cafes, usually a little bit without food, but also doing all your regular coffee drinks, like at a Starbucks, you get like lattes, cappuccinos, drip coffees, the whole gamut, using usually a little bit of higher grade bean and everything. What I do specifically now is referred to as third wave coffee. It's been historically very resistant to organization. There are a couple of coffee unions, though, that have grown up in the past couple years in the specialty coffee industry. Specifically, there's the Gimme Coffee Union, which I believe is in Syracuse, New York. But in general, it's been really hard. There, IWW had some very unsuccessful campaigns trying to organize Starbucks baristas a couple years ago now. It's just really incredibly hard. I believe it was in the East Coast. I think New York City, but don't quote me on that. When I looked into like who could I organize a union with, there was essentially no unions that were like, we want to organize retail workers, like almost at all, or that wasn't, it's not really in any of their scope, essentially.
Touch on what the IWW is for.
Oh, yeah, the International Workers of
the World, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Like, wait, what does it stand for? I don't even know. They're great, very left-leaning.
They're anarchists, right?
They're mostly anarchists. I don't have a lot of ties to them, so I can't speak to them, like, from a lot of personal experience, but I have followed some of their campaigns. In Portland, they had the Burgerville Union, which was their thing, which I've drawn a lot of inspiration from, and their kind of tactic is actually to do things a lot not by the book. So they don't really, you know, they don't go through all the NLRB kind of channels that you would maybe normally go through. And a lot of it, but I think this is also why I've been inspired by them, especially with the Burgerville one, is it's like what I do where they're individual stores. They're all owned by the same person, but it's very atomized. So it's really hard to get the whole bargaining unit together to organize them. This is, for me, the main challenge of doing coffee shops, especially in a larger company. But what they did is they did store by store. And technically, I think you can't do that. But they do. And it's all about doing direct action in the workplace to affect change. And even if it's not like a union that is recognized by the NLRB, it's still doing things to affect change in the workplace. And I think they've been somewhat effective with that.
We haven't really defined what a barista is.
Yeah, so what I do, I'm a barista. I've worn different hats in the coffee industry, but that's what I do now. And it's essentially the person who just makes the coffee drinks on the floor, it's customer service, it's food service. I've been in management before. I've had my own coffee co-op as well, so I've worn many different hats in the industry. Obviously, in a job, I've done a lot of training and management, even if I wasn't supposed to, which happens a lot.
Has there been specific moments, like in recent history, like let's say Occupy or the 2008 recession, or let's say the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, and now, has that gave people more consciousness within your workplace to possibly organize, or at least give you kind of sort of some avenue for some tools to organize with folks within the workplace, or talk to unions outside the workplace and try to get people kind of motivated to come together as a collective?
I have not personally seen like a major political or social catalyst for the growing class consciousness in the specialty coffee community. I think it's evolved with the rest of society, especially since it's largely dominated on the barista level by younger folks, so between 20 and 35 or so. I wish there was something like, oh, well, after, you know, with the whole Bernie campaign, everyone I work with is now on board for a union. Unfortunately, that's not the case. There's basically two big factors, so it's been really hard to gain traction for unionizing coffee shops. One is what I touched on earlier, the kind of atomized experience where it's shift work. You work with maybe a couple other people at a time. Some stores are bigger. You work with more people. But essentially, it's really easy not to have interaction with the whole bargaining unit. So that makes things a little bit more difficult when it comes to just disseminating information and talking about things. The other thing is just the culture of what, and this is what's really changing, what I'm really excited about, is the culture of what this kind of job is, who has this kind of job. When I started, when I was a teenager, it was, I'm in college, I'm only doing this job because, you know, I'm just trying to pay some bills while I'm, you know, in school, or, I'm only doing this until I get, you know, a real job. And there's still people who, you know, will say, this is not a real job. And I found that has changed a lot, because one thing, people have made this their career because they're really passionate about it. I'm privileged to have worked with a bunch of people who really care about what they do. I do this job because I love it. And it's something I'm really passionate about. It's not the only thing I do with my life, but I do actually enjoy what I do for a living. And there's a lot that makes it really difficult, but like the actual action of what I'm doing, I enjoy. And I think there's a lot of other people like me who do this for that reason. And they're starting to realize, wait, why is it that I don't have the same kind of protections as people in other industries? If I want to make this my career, I need more from the company than, you know, just, you know, minimum wage and, you know, slap on the back and everything, you know?
Yeah, what is the typical wage, if you want to comment on that, for like a barista?
So minimum wage in San Francisco is $15 an hour, or I think it's actually slightly above that right now. It just got raised to 15, which was like the big push over a couple of years to make it that. The baseline now raises with some kind of consumer price index every year. So what a lot of companies, food service at least, is that their competitive wage, which I love that when they use that term, is usually $1 or $2 above minimum wage, so 16, 17. And that's regardless of how much experience you have generally, especially for a bigger company. So most baristas are probably getting hired in between $16 and $17 an hour at the company that I work for.
For folks that are listening in, housing in the Bay Area has been continuously skyrocketing. There's heavy gentrification, not only in SF, but like Oakland, Richmond, etc. And people have a hard time living. They got to work two, three jobs to rent out a home in the Bay Area.
So it's not. However, as a barista, and most people realize this, do make tips. And for me, it's an average of about $10 an hour. So it's essentially a third of my income. It's the only reason why I can afford to live in the city. Being from here, I have the privilege of having the connections to find cheaper housing, which even for some people who are from here don't have that. Some years ago, it used to be more common for people just to move here, get a service job, and you know, find a room on Craigslist that was relatively inexpensive. And, you know, it's always been expensive in the city, but it was a doable thing. And then, you know, you might move on or you could use that job as a stepping stone. Now it is absolutely impossible. And I see that people want to move here who are not in certain class, like techies or whatever. There are people who want to move here to work a service job and live in San Francisco because it's, you know, there are reasons to move here. But you simply cannot, even with tips, afford a market rate apartment with roommates, even, you know, it's just not possible. I would say just to like rent a room in someone else's house, you're looking at on average about $1,500 a month. I know people who pay more than that. A lot of people pay less, and like I said, that they generally grandfathered into a situation because there is some good tenant protections here in San Francisco. We've fought for those, and that's good. But a lot of those are really for the people who've been here for a while. So when you just move here, you're looking to, you know, rent a market rate apartment. If you actually wanted to rent your own spot, just a studio, looking at $2,000 to $3,000 a month. So that is just absolute, and that's just a studio. Yeah, and
like what, 400 square feet?
Yeah, something like that. You know, like with, you don't even know if you're gonna have like a kitchen in the studio. Yeah. You know, like, and depending on the neighborhood you're in and everything, it's really tough. And it's also not even. As someone who's had to look for housing in the city, sometimes for me, the price wasn't even the thing. It was a lot of barriers to entry of finding a place. I mean, this is a whole nother story.
Yeah.
Like you had to put at least 10 grand down just to rent an apartment.
That's insane.
So like I might be able to afford this place, but I don't have, you know, just $10,000 lying around to put down. But a lot of other people do. Needless to say, it's tough out there for people in the bottom rung.
These are actually very important details for folks that are working in service or working minimum wage jobs that need living, and in order to get to work, a lot of people live very far away and take BART to the city, and that is a long trip for one, and then probably exhausting for a lot of folks that have families and such too.
Oh yeah, definitely. A lot of my coworkers live in the East Bay, which is slightly cheaper, not as much anymore. It's gone up a lot. It used to be a good cost saving. It's not really as much anymore, especially if you had to factor in the cost of commute, which if you're taking BART 5 days a week is, I think, probably about $200 a month or something. So if you're not paying less than that, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
Plus the time. However, the good thing when it comes to labor organizing that's happened recently is because it's so expensive to live here, there's a huge labor shortage for trained baristas, especially actually line cook, sous chefs and things like that in the fine dining, because businesses refuse to pay more than this like $16 or $17 an hour. I know some people get maybe 18, 19, but even then, that's really, this is not a lot more every month for us in living in San Francisco. So a lot of people just moved away. Or if you're in your job, you're not moving from job to job because you're usually like, you're there because maybe you're getting taken care of or like there's really not better options somewhere else. But the good thing about that is I've seen this kind of growing class consciousness and idea of like, oh, my labor is important. They need me more than I need them in that kind of way. Like if I left, they would be kind of effed. And I've seen a lot of baristas use this to their advantage to, you know, make slightly more. They can actually kind of make that threat. Well, I'll walk tomorrow. I could get a job at any of these other coffee shops. They'll have me in a second. And they've been able to bargain for a higher rate. Fortunately, at where I work, which is a slightly larger company, they don't really care. They're like, fine, bye. Good luck, you know. Because they seem to still be able to get people, although they do have a hard time still, especially when we talk about like quality of labor. Anyone can do this job. Almost anyone. I won't say anyone, but it's the kind of job that most people can be trained to do. Right. To be able to do it very well actually takes many years of experience. Mm-hmm. And that's the other part of the culture of like, oh, well, it's a job anyone can do. And it's like, that's technically true, but you could kind of say that about almost any job at that point, you know, but when you work, and I've had the privilege to work with people who are really good at what they do, you notice the difference, and the customers notice the difference as well. Now, like, experienced barista labor has a premium in the city, but not a lot. Gotcha. But there is that idea of like, oh, wait, I'm not completely beholden to my employer. I think that's changed a lot. As much as 10 years ago, it used to be like, I'm scared of my boss firing me because I don't know what I'm going to do. And it's still a fear a lot of people have, but it's a little bit different. You have that kind of like, you know, you have that power. Mm-hmm. And if I can get people to realize I have even more power collectively, that's, you know, that's the next step.
Yeah, just people, I guess, getting a certain like comfort zone. Mm-hmm. By just at least having a job, right? And then trying to make some sort of disruption in the workplace might make people think like, oh, I'm going to get fired, so like I'm not going to ruin this opportunity for myself or my family, for example.
Right.
So it's a very challenging thing to get people like collectively.
Yeah.
They can't fire all of us, right?
Right. And it's not to say that it's not scary anymore. It's just at least there's that kind of baseline of I know that there's another job out there for me, so that if I screw this over for some reason, like, I'm gonna be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have the experience too, and if you've made some good relationships. I do kind of worry about talking about unionization a lot, of like, oh, am I gonna burn some bridges? Yeah. You know, but so far so good.
If you want to mention any statistics about working conditions for baristas, folks that are in food service, just to kind of get more details in terms of what affects you directly as a worker.
I know that on average, people of color make less. And some of this has to do with tipping practices as well. I was involved with a wage survey, which was trying to kind of get some of that information as to see in San Francisco if there is some correlation between things like race, gender, and pay discrepancies. My partner, who also worked in coffee for a long time, did a wage transparency at one of his coffee jobs and found that, which was actually a woman-owned business, very interesting, found that most of the women he worked with all made significantly less than the men. Wow. And for no reason. I personally think it was due to like implicit biases that even the woman business owner probably had. Mm-hmm. And this happens a lot, and then we also don't realize it unless there's transparency involved with that. In the company I work for, I see a certain type of person often get promoted, and they tend to be lighter skinned, a lot of males, but also we do have a lot of women in our leadership team, which is great, but there's not a lot of diversity, unfortunately. Also, one of the reasons why I've always been attracted to being a barista is there's tend to be a lot of LGBT people in the industry. And so there's been a lot of solidarity there. There's usually someone I work with who, like, I can relate to as an LGBT person, part of that. It's really important. However, there has been a lot of transphobia, particularly is the big one now that the coffee industry is working on in a lot of specialty coffee shops, and misogyny kind of due to that. As a someone who identifies as a gay man, it's been easier for me. So I haven't seen that until more recently, when you really start to listen to, you know, the stories of your women employees, trans employees. And a lot of that's just a lot due to like cultural kind of stuff, like having to start, you know, ask for pronouns and stuff like that. And some companies are better at that than others, and actively trying to make things inclusive. And there's been a lot of great work around this recently.
Where do you draw the line as what is sort of like this rainbow capitalist type picture, as opposed to like actually supporting like liberation for these people within the workplace?
So I think what it kind of comes down to is it is very important for the cultural change, in the way I see it at least, to involve things like asking pronouns. It's a very simple way to get involved and make sure your employees feel included and safe. However, there are also huge structural things that need to happen along with that. So I love to see people out on Pride Parade. Visibility is important for certain reasons. It is the bare minimum. And when it comes to LGBT discrimination, I think it's really important to see it along with misogyny, because a lot of folks who do get discriminated against tend to fall towards that spectrum, like trans women, mm-hmm. queer women, people who do not fall within the gender spectrum. They're really the ones who often get the brunt of this. I've seen a lot of stories of trans employees getting fired because they're too difficult for whatever reason, especially if they start speaking up for their rights. This happens constantly and there is no protection for them at all. And to kind of touch on like labor practices and stuff that baristas deal with, as a lot of people know, it is a customer service job as well as just making products. If anyone is aware of the kind of retail situation in this country, there is a lot of abuse that is possible when it comes to dealing with customers. And there's a lot of very neoliberal policy in companies that erase your agency and dignity as a human when dealing with difficult situations. I've seen some very small kind of culture shifts around this, usually by people on the ground who have to deal with it all the time. Big companies love to say, like, we welcome everyone and, like, it all sounds really great and everything. But then when you have someone, especially as a woman or a trans person who is being absolutely unacceptable to you, suddenly it's an issue for you and not for them. So these are like culture things that just kind of, you know, are really difficult to deal with. And for anyone, it's difficult. And those are things I would like to see change around the culture, that like you cannot treat people like that because they work in this position.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, that's not okay. And
well, it's like a class division, right? It's like mm-hmm. usually people that come to get their coffee in the morning probably go, like, especially SF, it's probably like a lot tech folks that like work for tech companies like the Financial District or even more south, like towards Mountain View.
I try not to personally scapegoat certain classes of people who are also technically part of the working class. I try not to. It can be hard. I started my coffee career in the East Bay in Berkeley, and that was actually the worst. And these were generally older, probably more baby boomer type folk who were pretty well off for the most part. A lot of them who had probably went to school in Berkeley in the 60s, 70s, and then had then since settled there. They were the worst people to serve. Techies have actually been somewhat okay. This is all in the realm of just my own experience and those of my fellow baristas. Very interesting. They tend to be very clueless, but take orders very well. So I'm actually kind of okay with it. And you know, it's crazy what it comes down to is tipping culture, which is a large part of working in food service. And there is a lot of problematic stuff around that, because if I didn't have it, I couldn't afford to live here. But it doesn't mean that I make, you know, we don't all make the same amount. So it's really an issue. And it's still voluntary. So I try not to get mad at people who don't do it, but it's also my income. And a lot of people are so oblivious, or some of them, and they just don't think to do it. And but I want to get mad. Sometimes I do, but it's not compulsory. And people don't realize that, like, old generations, they love to, you know, oh, they give you the change. And it's like, you know, the 30s were a long time ago. Like, 25 cents is not worth that much.
Yeah.
So, you know, a dollar per drink, guys.
Yeah, at least, right?
Yeah. Anyone listening to this, a dollar per drink is preferred.
Yeah. And even like, just getting like a quick coffee, like somewhere, like, mm-hmm. and you pay with your card, right? Like, people put like zero on their tips all the time. I'm like, dude, like, this person at least served you, right?
Yeah.
So it's, and even at a bar, right? Like, I even tip like the bartender like quickly, because even though it's like I'm just gonna buy a shot or something like that, it's just at least I give you $1 at least, you know.
Well, I like to make it bring it back to that, because a lot of people are like, you would never think of not leaving a dollar per drink at a bar, but for some reason a coffee shop is totally okay. That being said, like I said before, it's not compulsory, so I'm not gonna, you know, go up to them and it's like, well, you need to do that next time, because you don't have to. You really don't have to, and that's one of the issues. And I did make a while ago like a wish list of what I would like to see for labor practices in especially coffee, and I would love to see tipping done away with, but that means that probably the drinks need to already be a dollar more, and that needs to come, and we need to make that in our wage. And I think most baristas out there would probably tell you that they would prefer that.
Yeah.
Because then everyone's paying the same price.
Yes.
It's basically, it's a really bizarre system that has come up, and it actually came out of racist practices. Look it up. Basically, to not pay people, you know, their fair wage, and to expect the customers to pay the rest of it.
Yeah, then some states, like, you have the minimum wage, but then, like, if you're a tipped worker,
exactly,
they can pay you less or something like that.
Right? So, also very lucky to live in California where that is illegal. A lot of people make as little as $2 an hour and are expected to, and they're supposed to make it up for you if you don't make that much in tips. However, I don't know if that, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of shady labor practices around that. Labor practices, God, there's so much there. I mean, that's also been my like specialty of like just recording anything that happens, well, specifically where at my workplace.
Yeah, I know you had like a survey too that you were sending out.
I did. I had a wage survey. And there's actually another one going out now because I feel like that's kind of like the bare minimum. Like we all know we don't get paid enough. Obviously, like, the, you know, the amount in San Francisco right now to even be kind of making it is around $40 an hour. And so with my tips, you know, I maybe make, you know, like 25 or something. So, you know, where is that extra $15 going to come from? And that's like bare minimum we're talking about here. But there's also a lot of other things that happen. I do get some benefits where I work. I get some PTO. I get
healthcare.
Which is oftentimes too expensive for me to use. It's a Kaiser plan health insurance.
So by too expensive to use, you mean like copay or?
So yeah, so my annual deductible is something like $6,000 a year or something. Mm-hmm. So like I'm grateful to have health insurance. That means I can go to the doctor occasionally if I have something wrong. If something really bad happens to me, thankfully I will not have to file bankruptcy. However, I will be out more than I can afford to pay for a long period of time. And that has actually, I don't want to drag my company too much for that because that has more to do with the health system in America overall. And I don't really think they should be paying for it anyways.
That's the whole issue with private insurance, right? Mm-hmm. You have this employee-based insurance, which everyone's like, oh, you should be working. And then it's like, well, that gives employers a reason to have more of a stranglehold on the workers where it's like, for example, the UAW strikes happen right now. Mm-hmm. They took away their health insurance,
right?
Which was kind of a tool to kind of get them to end their strike. So it's like in that burden on companies to pay for the health insurance, they can hire more workers for one, and then two, possibly pay higher wages as well. So we talk about like the $15 minimum wage, like what Bernie Sanders is talking about, and Medicare for all and Green New Deal and all this stuff. And it's like if people want to talk about keeping like capitalism kind of like intact for some capacity,
right,
then at least take some burden off these companies so we can actually liberate people from this system that we're in.
I say this a lot about places I've worked where it's like they offer some of these really bizarre benefits where I'm like, I would really rather you just gave me the money. Something that a lot of these companies do is to say that they're competitive so they can pay a very low wage, and if they add all these benefits, which a lot of employees don't even get, I'm just gonna say, or they can't even access for whatever reason, they add that into your like wage and like, oh, well, you're actually making this much. You're not making that much. If I'm not taking that home to pay my bills myself, I'm not making, you know, like it's just not happening. So we do. So we get some good things like PTO. However, they came out with these policies to kind of like dampen the good things they do. So for instance, recently they enshrined this policy that you can't take any more time off than you have PTO. Unless you're sick and you have like a doctor's note. So if I only realistically get maybe 1 to 2 weeks a year PTO, that's all the amount of time I'm able to take off. No, I need more time off than that. You know, it's not very much. And a lot of it's also it's punitive because it's more about them saying that they can say no to you as opposed to it something that you can take. Time off is actually a really big thing for a lot of people in service in general. It can be really difficult if you need someone to cover your shift to be able to take time off. If you have an inconsistent schedule, you can't schedule things like vacations. This is really important. But I think what I'm trying to say is that there's a lot of little like policy things in a lot of these, especially bigger companies, that are really, really kind of awful. Oh, another one in my company, for instance, recently, they decided that we weren't going to get raises every year like we normally do. And the only way to get a raise was to get a promotion, which is something that's really frustrating because you could work somewhere for a really long time and still make, you know, $16 an hour. And also, I don't think they think of it this way, but only certain people are going to be able to get a promotion. There's not promotions for anyone. That's just not how it works. Mm-hmm. And there will be biases with that, probably due for like race and gender, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really, you know, it's just not okay. We should be getting guaranteed raises every year with, you know, maybe a performance incentive on top of that. That should just be a thing, you know, just like not even to think about. But like what I'm trying to say is that there's a lot of these like, oh, well, we do all these great things, and yet they're all mitigated like where they don't actually have to do them. And we see this in corporate America all the time. And it mainly affects people at the very bottom. Since I work at a large company, we have a whole administrative team that are getting a complete different package than I am as a barista, which to me is unacceptable. Yeah. And I do not want to pit one group of working class folks against the other. But I would love to see some solidarity with that, because they're like a separate kind of class. They're the managerial classes, yeah, as it were. And they get all the regular benefits. They get their holidays off. They get holiday pay. You know, all this kind of stuff. They obviously make more. And when you ask, like, why do you think they deserve to, make this? Like, well, that's, those are the competitive prices. And it's like, so you don't think baristas are worth more than $15 an hour, essentially, because we just don't deserve it, It's, and a lot of it's, like, coming back to, just changing the culture around, like, what labor is worth more than others.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. That's kind of like this, like, kind of feudal, like, concept, right? Yeah. It's like you're a damn peasant. Like,
yeah.
Because all you do is make coffee,
Yeah, which is essentially the only thing that's making, like, we're the ones who built this company, which is what's insane.
Exactly, yeah. Like, labor creates all wealth, right? Yeah. That's what we talk about as communists, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, people keep talking about, like, capitalism made your iPhone. Like, workers made that iPhone.
Exactly.
Not Tim Cook or Steve Jobs, you know? Like,
no. Yeah.
They created the wealth off of their workers. Like, they would not be there without their workers and their company. Like,
exactly.
So anyways.
Yeah. And that's, and I'll just say that's what really, in the end, I'd always been left-leaning, but attracted me to socialism was because I live it. Mm-hmm. Every day I see the labor that I create and the discrepancy between how much I make. And I talk about it at work all the time, and I'm sure my coworkers are sick of it. But
yeah, there's no union in my personal workplace, and I talk about, like, okay, I come in with, like, a bunch of student debts, mm-hmm, and they're not willing to compensate me at all when people have been there for 30-something plus years, mm-hmm, came in with no debt, and are, like, able to buy houses and such in the Bay Area. And I'm like, I will never be able to afford a house out here because I have thousands of dollars of student debt, mm-hmm, that I have to pay off before I can even think about putting a down payment on a house out here, which is, like, $1 million, Yeah. It's just, like, there's no fucking way I can survive out here.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's just keep moving on. Yeah. So, since we're in the Bay Area, and I know in Oakland, for example, and Richmond and Berkeley and also SF, there's a bunch of small coffee co-ops, mm-hmm, and I know you've been involved with the co-op as well.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious about the difference between, like, let's say a cooperative, mm-hmm, owned workplace, like where workers own the means of production, like they own equal share of the company, mm-hmm, as opposed to, like, let's say a non-unionized or unionized workplace, let's say, like, in a company, mm-hmm, that's privately owned.
So my own personal experience is that I did open up a small coffee bar with some friends, and we operated as a collective. Actually, technically, it was not a co-op because we never incorporated. It's very technical, though, and there's a lot of good reasons to do it, but since we were a very small operation, there was five of us, we operated as a collective. So essentially, the same thing. We all had an equal share. We all had one vote for anything that came up. We were open for about a year and had to close, actually not due to economic reasons, more to do with the space that we were in. Long story short, we were only open for a year. It was an amazing learning experience. I would love to do it again. It was also incredibly difficult. Co-op, and I think one of the issues, and it all comes back to culture and class consciousness, the thing about working in a co-op or any kind of collective consensus-driven venture is everyone has to be on the same page, and this is very difficult, especially when I am used to working in a strictly hierarchical, almost military, authoritative style workplace. And there's actually, and I will admit this, there is a lot of comfort in that because there's no responsibility on you as the person on the bottom. Actually, there's a lot of responsibility on you, but in theory, there's not. So you can always deflect higher, and it's easier in some ways and more efficient for someone just to tell you what to do and you do it. However, you have no say, at all. And even though it's more work to have a say in your workplace, I would much rather do that work and than not, personally. But it's really hard to get other people involved in that and to really care. So I would love to open up another co-op someday. But you really need people who are really super on board to the whole process, because it's not just, oh, we're all going to make coffee together. It's making every single decision together, which gets really bogged down really quickly. But in the end, I love it because it's really your thing. You have public ownership of it. And it's also not about you. It's a lot of capitalist culture that's, like, so wrapped up in our egos, where it's like the whole CEO kind of culture of, like, I made this. This is my thing. And people are like, oh, like, that guy, he's my hero. And it's like, no, we made this. This is our thing. And I want that to be, like, you know, when you go into any kind of business, I want people to like feel that of like, oh, it's not just this one person. It's like everyone kind of doing it. And there are some co-op. There's, as far as I know, there's not any in San Francisco. For coffee, that is. Okay. Yeah. There's definitely some. There's like Arizmendi, which is like the big one. And they actually do a lot of work. They're kind of almost like a franchise. They'll help you. Like, and in East Bay, there's, well, there was in Berkeley, there's one. And then Oakland, there's a, I think Red Bay it is, co-op model. Fortunately, I don't know anyone who works for either of those places or at least anymore. And I wish them the best. Because we really need more of that. If we're not going to have any coffee unions, I would love to see more cooperative. But yeah, but like I said, it's just hard to get people involved because the culture of working this kind of job is very low engagement, which is kind of fine. But I want say over what happens in my workplace. Also, as people who've worked in these kind of jobs long enough know, management does not always know the best thing to do. And people who are actually working the job do. And we often are also not listened to, or where I work, we are listened to a lot. I give a lot of feedback and they ask for it, which is great. They don't do anything I say ever. They're always going to do whatever's going to make them more money,
Yeah, exactly.
Which is very frustrating. So it's like, you can't give us a voice and then not do anything anyone tells you to do. To me, it's almost more frustrating.
Yeah.
I'd rather you just do whatever the hell you're going to do and not.
Yeah, don't say shit. Yeah. Capitalism,
yeah.
Right?
So yeah.
That's the beast you're fighting. So. Let's be imaginary, I guess. Let's say Starbucks tomorrow unionized their workers and went bankrupt or something like that. They got rid of the company and the union took over the ownership of the workplace. Do you ever see that like in a foreseeable future happening, or if it's just like that's no fucking way it's going to ever happen?
I personally, if we're talking about like the scale of like Starbucks or other companies
I guess it's
probably not as much. I think it would have to start with smaller businesses. I actually had seen this before, but I know Bernie Sanders has on his platform a right to first refusal for companies to go co-op and then a whole fund for that as well. I think things like that are really important. There is another business in Berkeley that a friend of mine worked at, not coffee related, that was trying to do that. The owners are old. They wanted to sell. Their first idea was to sell to the employees. I'm not sure if it's going through or not, but I love to see things like that. It also, I think it's important that that's made an option. We never think of that as being an option for employees to do. It's very similar to also, what's the phrase? Like when people take over their building they live in. We never think of that, like if the landlord tries to sell to give the tenants right of first refusal. I feel like it's kind of similar to that idea of like, we never see that as being an option. I feel like that should always be the first option. I would love to see that. And I know, this actually also happened recently in Four Barrel Coffee, which had a Me Too scandal a couple years ago. Very big deal. The owner who was involved with it is no longer with that company. There was talk that they were going to also go co-op after that, because I think all the owners wanted to kind of wipe their hands of it. Unfortunately, it did not happen, and I was really sad about that. I didn't know anyone there at the time, so I didn't know how to make any inroads into that. But you see this thing kind of happening, and there's a conversation about it, and I think employees start thinking like, wow, wait, we could actually do this? What does that mean? What does it look like? And like I said before, it comes down to like, do people really want to be that involved in their job with making decisions? And that's where I want to empower people to be like, yes, you do. You really do. And here's why.
From what I've heard from a friend from several years back, that due to climate change, coffee is like no longer made anymore because like plants is like going to get destroyed through in the climate crisis. So
it really affects my industry. There's something called coffee leaf rust that is decimating crops. I think mostly in Latin America. I'm not sure if it's in places like Africa and Indonesia or Southeast Asia. But it has to do with the fact that coffee is all the same. All the coffee, all the varieties you can get, which all taste incredibly different, are all the same exact species for the most part. They're all made from, you know, a small group of organisms that are now, you know, very genetically similar. So obviously, as we know from other parts of agriculture, this can lead to issues. And they're also, with climate change, you know, the growth conditions for growing coffee will change. The other thing to note, I think, which is really important, is sustainability for the industry. A lot of coffee shops in the United States have done a lot to make sure that there is zero waste and everything. Where I work, we're fairly good at that, I think. However, just the cost of shipping coffee all across the world is a huge carbon emission. And so that could change, you know, things in the future. I worry about that just because I do think there will come a time that it will become more of a luxury for a lot of people. There probably will always be cheap coffee available because it's important to capitalism that people are given this drug. There's been some good writing out there with tracking the growth of capitalism, especially in the 19th century industrial age, with the growth of coffee, the coffee industry. It's been hand in hand. Yeah, like in the factories, in the 1800s, everyone had access to coffee. It was cheap, crappy coffee, probably watered down a lot, but they had to have it because this is what kept people working for 10, 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And eating probably nothing, you know? So it was really important. They were just given it on the job. And it's still kind of true to this day. I work in the industry. I see everyone who needs, these people need their coffee to get to work.
Yeah, I do too.
I can relate. I'm a daily drinker, obviously, and it's my job. That's actually very interesting. You know, that's a whole another podcast there, probably. But
I thought I'll bring it up though, because I thought, yeah, because there's this woman I knew from, several years back, that she was in, agricultural sciences, mm-hmm. and she was talking about, how coffee's not going to be available for people, in, 20, 30 years from now.
It's possible. There's a lot of work around this. There's something that I found really interesting, and we had their coffee briefly at my work, this place called Goodland Organics, which are based around Santa Barbara. They're trying to cultivate coffee that can be grown at sea level. So just for people who don't know, coffee grows best on volcanic soil about 1,000 meters above sea level, in equatorial regions. And that's where it grows the best. That's why we see it in Latin America, in Africa, where it's from originally, like Ethiopia, and in Southeast Asia. They have the correct growing conditions for it. You can grow it at lower altitudes. It tastes awful. So I tried this coffee, the cultivated coffee that is, it's palatable, only just. It's also very expensive. Gotcha. But the whole idea is, if they can make coffee that is palatable, that you can grow at these lower elevations, that is commercially viable, that's a game changer. If we could get coffee that's grown in California, who knows with climate change, you know, it's a crapshoot. But, that's a game changer. That's a real game changer.
I was going to ask one last question, and mm-hmm. we've kind of touched on this a bunch, but to bring up monopolization of coffee, like Starbucks, et cetera, and how that has affected the working class and, I guess, society as a whole as well, if you have any comments on that, and how can we change that type of thing to make it more decentralized,
yeah,
pretty much isn't some of these big cultural cities like the Bay Area. I feel like there's a lot of small coffee shops, mom and pop shops for coffee, but if you go to a normal Midwest town, it's only Starbucks.
So I wouldn't necessarily say they're a monopoly, but you're right, probably in some regions they kind of are for specialty coffee. I think it's important to know that Starbucks is considered a specialty coffee company. They make specialty drinks. So it's a certain way of making coffee that they do have a very large market share of. I think large companies like that, I also work for one that's slightly different, not quite as big, but also very fastly expanding and trying to take over their market share. I think it's really important to ask yourself as a company, and of course they're not going to do this because this is capitalism, but there's a certain kind of imperialism. And when Starbucks was growing, this was a conversation that was had a lot, where it's... if you're going to open up in a city or a district, why do you think you should be there as opposed to a mom and pop? I don't want to also glorify mom and pop businesses, but they do tend to at least keep money in the community a little bit more. I work for mom and pops, and it also can be a hellish place to work, and there's a lot of issues around that we won't get into. But I think there's a lot to be said that, communities are more economically vibrant when they're more, small shareholders. And I would love to see those all be co-ops personally. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen the argument that when we have these large corporations, if there's a mass workers movement, which isn't happening just yet, it actually makes it easier to take over control or the reins of these large enterprises. I've heard this about Amazon. It's we already have this what could be a state-run apparatus that would be able to distribute goods to all these people. Mm-hmm. We just need to take it away from, Mr. Bezos. Exactly, So, you can kind of argue both ways, I think. I personally, just for cultural and, personal reasons, I'd love to see a satellite of co-ops. I think that would be ideal. And people just really getting to control their own lives in that kind of small kind of way.
Yeah.
I think people would be more satisfied that way. But there's a lot to say, you know, especially as communists, part of the party, like, you know, taking control over these big entities and being like, we could use these for the common good in ways that they are not doing right now.
Yeah, we could do it for ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are obviously co-ops in the Bay Area. There's Federation of Cooperatives, like, let's say, Jackson, Mississippi, this Cooperation Jackson thing that I've been following pretty closely. I don't think they do coffee, but they've done, like, housing, like, community land trusts where they put some money together as a cooperative and buy land, and they can democratically decide what goes in that land, et cetera. Yeah. And it's owned by the trusts, so they own it for, like, 100 years without any involvement from private capitalists or the state. So it's theirs, you know. And this tradition has lasted for, I don't know, hundreds of years, right? People have done this for themselves, especially Black people, actually, in their own communities. So it's a very interesting concept, and I think the party needs to be involved with these struggles as well. Not just hope for the state to take over everything. Like, because we got to live in reality too, right? It's like the U.S. is an empire and an extremely large country, and even with, like, let's say, a Bernie Sanders presidency, there may be more takeover of, like, large, let's say, energy industries to, like, push for renewable energy, etc. But we got to kind of be realistic within our own communities and think about how do we address these problems ourselves, you know, as activists, as local people in these communities, Black, white, etc. You know, these are things that I think we can take up as opposed to just strictly being on elections, you know, hoping for some Democrat or socialist to save us. You know? Like, we can't put all our energy there, right? Yep. It's we have our own communities, our own families, etc., which where we can actually make some change directly. So, but with that, I guess we should end now, because I know we got places to go.
I would like to plug a couple of accounts that I follow that are doing really great work. One is Coffee at Large. They're on Instagram. They're probably on Facebook as well. They're based in Seattle, and they do a lot of workplace justice kind of stuff. And they, I think they're the ones who started, or actually no, it was some other baristas, but there's a lot of regions are now doing wage surveys. And the one in San Francisco is being done by what's called the BACC, the Bay Area Coffee Community, which is a very interesting. They actually do a lot of good work. They also, they work a lot with owners and coffee professionals, so I'm not as involved with that. I would love to actually see, like, a barista labor council kind of situation in the Bay Area that's really only on the side of working class baristas and that don't involve management or owners. I mean, a union would be great too, but, you know, like, at least have that kind of resource. In any case, that was off topic. Yeah, and they're doing great work. So if you go onto their Instagram, there's a link to the wage survey if any baristas are listening to this. If you're in another region and you want to make one of these surveys, you can contact them, and I think they would help. That would be a Coffee at Large, I think. If anyone wants to follow me, I'm on Instagram at The Loading Zone. The O in zone is a zero because that was already taken. Do a lot of artwork as well as activism. I do a lot of political art, among other things. I guess that's about it.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Nick, for spending some time with me and doing your first podcast interview.
How exciting.
Hopefully there'll be more in the future.
Yeah.
And yeah, in solidarity with you and all your organizing efforts. And I'm hoping the best for you and your future within the empire.
Thank you. Yeah, great.